Thank you very much, Terry. I'm very excited to join you all with this panel of great speakers representing such a diverse range of organizations. As Terry noted, ESG, environmental, social, and governance, is a term used to describe a company or an organization's consideration of and commitment to social and environmental factors. Investors may use it to evaluate or score companies for investment potential. It may impact stock or asset valuation, and it may also impact recruiting and retention of talent. Whether or not an organization uses that actual term, ESG, the idea of triple bottom line values, finding the balance between environmental, social, and economic responsibility, is not a new idea. Many organizations, including the ones represented here on our panel, have been committed to these issues long before ESG was introduced into our lexicon. Our speakers all spend time specifically focused on their organization's real estate or building portfolios and sustainability and social and economic responsibility. They're going to talk about these values and how they're expressed in their organizations relative to the built environment. Very excited to introduce our first panelists, Brenda Sanchez, Senior Architect and Design Manager at the Smithsonian Institution, where she leads the design team for the National Museum of African American History, Culture, History and Culture. She's practiced architecture for over 25 years, leading numerous projects in planning, architecture, and facilities management. Before joining the Smithsonian Institution in 2004, she was a project manager at the Office of the University Architect at American University, and she previously owned her own firm, Brenda Sanchez Architects, for 9 years and worked at various award-winning firms before that. Charles Chandler is a senior leasing and asset manager at the Smithsonian Institution with over 20 years' experience in commercial real estate management, as well as leasing and project management. His asset management involves over 40 leased spaces with annual rent of approximately $34 million a year, plus virtually all of the Smithsonian-owned properties, including 19 museums, multiple research and administrative facilities, and the National Zoo. Thank you very much for being here, Brenda and Charles. We look forward to hearing from you.
Great, thank you. Brenda, would you like to start?
Yes, do you have my screen? Do you see my screen now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I am Brenda Sanchez, and I'd like to give you a little bit of introduction to the Smithsonian Institution. The Smithsonian Institution was established in 1846 as a trust instrumentality of Congress. Two-thirds of its budget for day-to-day operations and physical infrastructure is federally funded. We have over 6,000 employees, two-thirds of which are federal, and we have over 2,000 on-site volunteers and 50,000 active digital volunteers. Now, the mission of the Smithsonian is that of the acquiring and diffusing knowledge. So while we are known for our museums, our biggest goal is that of scientific research, which then gets shown to the public through our exhibitions. So
Brenda,
we have a range of jobs.
I'm sorry to interject. Brenda, no one is seeing your slides. Do you
Oh,
mind?
that's what I was asking, and I'm sorry, my
Yeah, no
apologies.
worries. There should be a share screen button down at the bottom, and just make
Yes.
sure. Yeah.
Share screen. I'm supposed to be sharing there.
No worries.
Okay.
Technology is great until it is. There we go. It looks like it's just now starting, and I see your desktop. And that's great. And if you'll just go to full screen mode.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Sorry to
Thank
interrupt.
you very much. I'm sorry for the mishap there. I was just giving an introduction on the Smithsonian Institution as background so we have an idea of what it is that we actually do. So, as I said, our mission is really that of the diffusion of knowledge. And because of that, we do have a range of jobs that are available: scientific research, exhibition design, museums operation, and security. In terms of social and governance goals, the Smithsonian works to attract and maintain a varied workforce representing America's diversity and expanding employment opportunities for individuals with disabilities. When I started at the Smithsonian 17 years ago, the top leadership was very white and very male. Today, women and other minorities are at the top of the leadership ladder, starting with our secretary, Dr. Lonnie Bunch, which is our first African-American secretary, our deputy secretary, Miroi Park, who is a woman of Asian descent, Kevin Young, who is the director of the National Museum of African-American History and Culture, and we have now six, actually out of last week, we have seven women leading some of our museums. That is a lot of progress. You can see here how our federal and trust employees by race and ethnicity, we have 53% white, 28.9 black, 10.6 Hispanic, with lower percentages than for Asian Native Americans and Native Hawaiian people. Of those, in terms of gender, we have 51% male, 49% female, and at 8% with people that have identified themselves as having disabilities. Now, the SIE values the American entrepreneurial spirit and has diverse suppliers in its contracting and procuring activities. So actually we track percentage goals of dollars that are targeted and awarded to small businesses that are small, historically underutilized, and fall into the HUSB categories. But my expertise as an architect is for the E part of ESG goals for the facility. We have 645 facilities that we own. Of those, 19 are museums. And we have a total of 12.6 square feet of space. We also have 36 facilities that are leased with a total of 1.5 square feet. And they are all over the United States and also international in Panama and even Chile. In terms of our sustainability, the sustainability movement of the Smithsonian started really as a grassroots movement. While there were scattered groups throughout the Smithsonian that tried to implement sustainability measures, they always ended up against the budget because, as I said, we only get 2/3 of our funds from the government. But for example, in 2004, there was an existing exhibits green group that complained that they were constantly having to make hard choices to be able to incorporate sustainability elements in their exhibits because there was no official Smithsonian policy regarding sustainability and therefore no funds allowed for that. So various groups at SI banded together and formed the first sustainability committee with the goal of getting an official Smithsonian directive which would commit the Smithsonian to sustainable practices. This would in turn allocate funds to the projects to comply then with the Smithsonian directive. So it was like this, that the Smithsonian directive 422 was issued outlining the Smithsonian policy on sustainability. And it was first issued in 2006. Now this applies to all our museums, research facilities and administrative offices, anything that is under the control of the Smithsonian in the United States and in international locations. We also have received lead awards for our projects in Panama. Now, this directive affirms the Smithsonian Institution commitment to being a holistic leader and to be an environmental steward by considering climate and environment in the design, construction, procuring, operations, and removal of buildings. So in doing so, the Smithsonian will aim at conserving natural resources, reduce pollution, and consider the long lifespan of the buildings. Now, this is how it started in 2006. Since then, sustainable design has evolved from improving building performance and reducing negative impacts on the environment to constructing facilities that actually contribute to the environment and the health and the comfort of its occupants. And in these, all phases of the facility's life cycle need to be considered, because we also have to keep into consideration the economic price of this. So the aim is an optimal balance of environmental, societal, human benefits, and costs, which also meets the mission and function of the intended facility or structure. At a minimum, the building, or Smithsonian directive calls for, at the minimum, the buildings need to comply with the current LEED certification, and any projects with a cost of less than 2.5 million needs to at least get certification. Projects with construction budget equal to 2.5 million, but less than 5 million must get silver. And projects with construction budget greater than or equal to 5 million must get the LEED Gold certification. As we have evolved with this Smithsonian directive and with the practice of sustainability, we now have included as aspirational goals a LEED Platinum and LEED Zero. Now, these are aspirational and appropriate for whatever project is on hand. Like at the moment, for example, I am working in the rehabilitation of the historic core of the Smithsonian. This includes both the castle and the arts and industries buildings. We have no site other than the gardens, and these are very old historic buildings that really are very difficult to make sustainable, but not entirely. We do that all the time since most of our buildings are old. However, it will be very difficult to get all to zero, to LEED Zero. What we're trying to do with this project, it was targeted for gold, and right now we are almost at a platinum level. And the whole idea is to get it as close to, or at least start leading the road towards LEED Zero, so that other projects that come behind us already have somebody that has explored that road. So, this is a listing of all our projects. Where the projects are not eligible for LEED certification, the LEED system may be used to select strategies that address the federal environmental and energy management requirements and that are applicable to the specific project. Or the design managers may choose alternative aspirational standards that advance the reduction of energy, water, and waste. In addition, in a project-by-project basis, the institution seeks additional sustainable certification as outlined in the aspirational principles of the Living Building Challenge, Well Building, Sustainable Sites, and Federal Guiding Principles certification. We have here a list of all the projects that we have already obtained LEED certification for. As you can see, we only have one platinum so far, which is the CERC Environmental Research, but we have a number of gold LEED certified projects, silver, and just plain certified projects. In terms of operations, I'm gonna give you some 2020 data, and this is for recycling. 43% recycling and composting rate we have at the moment. It has steadily improved as it goes through the years since we started recycling. And the energy intensity has also been reducing. Right now we are at 102,000 BTUs per square feet. And for the greenhouse emissions, we are at 93,000. So it is on track. We are on track of meeting the goals that we have had for a while from greenhouse and gas emissions. So these are really all our projects that we have. And as you can see, some of them are museums, but some of them are just, for example, here, Elephant Trails of the National Zoo, a conservation pavilion, a police station. So the variety of projects, the projects are very varied, because we are so large, we have so many facilities, and we are all over. So I hope that this gives you an introduction to our projects in facilities. And I'd like to introduce Charles Chandler, who will be able to address which our goals are and how we manage our rental facilities, our real estate portfolio. Charles?
Great, thanks Brenda, we appreciate it. As Brenda and Terry alluded to, I work in the leasing and asset management area for the Smithsonian Institution. And that is a little bit different perspective than the own portfolio. And as Brenda mentioned, a big part of the Smithsonian is educational and research and orientation. And so in addition to our museums, that there's a large research part in our research institutes where we actually are doing a lot of environmental research as part of our mission. When we're leasing properties, we try to lease LEED or Energy Star rated buildings to the greatest extent possible. And that's most achievable when it's a generic office building. Where it gets really challenging is leasing special spaced buildings such as collection spaces in modified warehouses for buildings that we don't own. And we try to influence those decisions similar to a lease that we're in the process of doing that was not a LEED or Energy Star rated building. And as part of our negotiations, we've gotten them to agree to become either LEED or Energy Star rated within the first 2 years of the lease. So that we're trying to use that as a leverage to move in that direction. When we get outside of the major metropolitan areas to smaller towns and cities, it is more challenging, and that's an area that we want to have greater influence in the future. And part of that is that we want to establish for us, but also to encourage others to establish stated goals of what we want to do in terms of leasing only LEED certified buildings, and that we encourage other organizations, corporations, and the like to publicly to state what they are seeking to do in terms of leasing buildings that have LEED or other energy related aspirations. And then also to report in their annual reports and perhaps even quarterly reports, what percentage of their footprint is in LEED or otherwise sustainable or environmentally sensitive buildings. And we encourage everyone to have metrics like that to know where we are on the line of improvement. So Terry and Annika, I will turn it back to you.
Thank you very much. So we will, and that's very exciting to see all the great work you've done with your portfolio. The Smithsonian, of course, has so many wonderful buildings full of great artifacts and pieces of our history and culture. We're moving now to our next speaker, Adrian Avino, who is the engineering construction manager at IKEA North America. He is the current LEED for approval of sustainable renewable energy projects, responsible for approval of $250 million in sustainability projects in the past 2 years, including really interesting technologies such as fuel cells and renewable heating and cooling projects. He's responsible for 85 sites over across the United States and Canada, building strategy for 2030, innovation and technology for 100% renewable energy in existing and future buildings, new energy efficient buildings and retrofits of existing buildings to become energy positive. We look forward to hearing what Adrian's working on. Adrian? And Adrian, you may want to test your video. Very good. And you're mute.
Adrian, can you unmute your mic?
There we go. Sorry about that. Thank you, Annika. It's a great pleasure to be here today. Thank you for the introduction. I am going to present today our Becoming People Planet Positive movement and our sustainability goals as we move forward towards 2030. As we have very ambitious sustainability goals in a chapter that I like to call Engineering Sustainability. Small introduction, I'm Adrian Avino, Engineering Construction Manager for North America, which encompasses both the United States and Canada. A little bit of the agenda for our presentation, I will go over the sustainability strategy in global terms, and then I will narrow down into what our real estate sustainability goals and objectives are all about with more granular goals and objectives. We'll focus on new projects and part of our big city center strategy, a key element in LEED certification. New site engineering and design, our existing asset strategy, and how we potentially want to achieve our sustainability goals with our existing assets, sustainability investments, and what our project approval criteria for those sustainability investments is, and then what type of engineering and construction technology we are actually implementing at our sites, existing and new projects. And if there's time for questions, any questions as well. IKEA was founded in 1953 by Ingvar Kamprad. We have over 400 locations global with presence in North America, Russia, China, Europe, Australia, and presently in South America as well. So we share a lot of global experiences with our global matrix partners and have great cross-functional collaboration worldwide. So a little bit of our sustainability strategy, part of our People Planet Positive movement. Our three pillars are healthy and sustainable living, where our ambition is to inspire and enable more people to live a better life within the limits of the planet. Circular and climate positive, where our ambition is to become climate positive and generate more resources while growing the IKEA business. And fair and inclusive, where our ambition is to create a positive social impact for everyone across the IKEA value chain. Our real estate strategy is the development of a sustainable real estate business. A little bit of how we are composed, real estate, construction engineering, facilities management and asset management, and then business development looks at sustainability, our expansion, how we plan to grow, and then an important part of innovation and co-creation, and then our customer fulfillment unit, which is development and operations. And part of our People Planet movement for 2030 is striving for zero waste and becoming 100% circular. Powered by 100% renewable energy, and to be able to generate more renewable energy than what we consume. Our real estate sustainability goals and objectives from today onwards are for all new projects and retrofitted buildings to use renewable heating and cooling systems. And I will dig a little bit deeper into that further on. We also want to be able to generate more renewable energy than what we consume in our operations, mainly through on-site investments. We do also have off-site renewable energy investments through one of our sister branches, INCA Investments. Nevertheless, it's the concept of what we call real estate positive to be able to generate more renewable energy on site than what we actually consume at each specific site. And then by 2025, we would like to achieve 100% renewable energy consumption. We want to be able to have increased energy efficiency by 35% compared to our fiscal year 10 baseline. We want to be able to double our on-site renewable energy generation compared to our baseline from fiscal year 2018. And we are creating an EV charging infrastructure to support zero emission fleets. By 2030, we want 100% renewable heating and cooling in all of our sites. We want increased energy efficient by 40% compared to our baseline fiscal year 2019. And we want to triple our on-site renewable energy compared to our baseline fiscal year 2019. Some of our approval criteria for sustainability investments, I would say these are the two big financial hurdles that we have. When we look at a site, we want the site to have a P&L positive impact in what the sustainability investment respects, and to have a payback under 10 years. And to dig a little bit deeper into that, we have an internal cash flow for that, where we have, for example, a PV project under a certain table of assumptions, a utility per dollar kilowatt escalation rate, state tax rate, PV degradation rate, service cost escalation, which is the service cost projected of what energy will cost in the future. And of course, in the US, we have federal ITC credit, which is currently at 26%. So that gives us, the PV system gives us the production, and we analyze the savings from solar, which are potentially from coming from the state or local authority having jurisdiction. If we have the possibility of incorporating an energy storage system, that is also contemplated here. And this is the impact that we want to have at each site, is that P&L positive impact through our 25-year cash flow model. So each year in and out, we want that to be a positive impact and reduce bottom line operational expenses to our stores. So ultimately we could see that our customers ultimately have that savings and so forth. And then the payback, hopefully under 10 years as well. As part of our new projects in IKEA big city centers, we consulted with our customers and developed what we call psychographics, and we determined that our ideal customers are located in certain parts of North America. And our big city center strategy is composed of small format stores, anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 square feet to 100,000 square feet within San Francisco, LA, Washington, DC, Chicago, in New York, where we recently opened a small format store of 100,000 square feet in Queens. And this big city center strategy is accompanied with central distribution centers and distribution centers to be able to supply to the many. Part of this big city center strategy is having these small format stores within walking limits of many of our customers, having metro subway available for them to be able to reduce our carbon footprint and make those sites accessible to everyone. Our new projects are LEED certified silver as minimum for the IKEA retail portion, and our sister branch Inca Centers recently came to North America, and they basically act as a shopping center. We recently acquired this building in San Francisco, which is called 6x6, which we will hopefully be opening soon. And IKEA retail goes in as the main anchor, and Inca Centers leases the rest of the spaces to tenants. And that will potentially have, our ambition is for that to be LEED Gold, and IKEA retail will go with minimum requirement of LEED Silver, with always the ambition of going for gold. Some of the key elements in engineering design, construction, and LEED certification that I wanted to highlight is improved indoor air quality, natural lighting, comprehensive waste management, lower energy costs, promote walkability, encourage public transportation, bicycle facilities, improved energy performance, advanced energy metering, renewable energy production, green power and carbon offsets, which once again is through our Inca investment branch as well, where we own several wind and solar farms throughout the US and offset and retire solar recognizable energy credits for that green power and for that carbon offset. And then construction and demolition waste. Our ambition is for the construction process to have zero waste as well. New site engineering and design. Once again, our minimum requirement is to go for LEED Silver. If we can, we will go for gold, even platinum if feasible. And then some of our engineering concepts that we evaluate when we look at a new site, whether it's a small format store or a distribution center, is high efficiency in building envelope. So we want the U value or the R value to have that added insulation for increased energy performance within the constraints of our building. And then orientation also plays an important part in energy efficiency as well. So if we can orientate the building in a way where it receives the sun's rays and it makes it more energy efficient throughout the day's operations, we would definitely want that building to have that orientation. And then renewable heating and cooling, we would analyze different HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems, geothermal being one of them, air source heat pumps, water source heat pumps that would not contemplate the use of fossil fuels. Geothermal is one of the preferred system design options that our global matrix partners in Europe use. So we do analyze that system. We have four sites in North America that have geothermal systems. EV chargers, we have customer facing and electronic yoke truck chargers as well that we implement on our sites as a holistic approach for all the renewable energy initiatives that we could potentially place on one of these sites. And then a battery energy storage system for peak shave demand. And then an important concept that I would like to mention is that we design our PV system to potentially offset 100% of our energy consumption. So we put together an energy model that really takes into consideration all the energy consumption that all of the elements, HVAC equipment, automation equipment, cash register, you name it, that goes into the building. So let's say it gives us 1 million kilowatt hours of energy consumption. We eventually design our PV system to hopefully offset that 1 million kilowatt hours of energy consumption and have it be a real estate positive building to produce more energy than what it consumes, or what is typically known as a net zero energy building, to be neutral. Our existing asset strategy, we have over 85 locations in between the United States and Canada. We have 50 stores in the US, 14 stores in Canada. And we are trying to retrofit all these projects so that we can accommodate our sustainability goals and objectives. And here's where we have several challenges as well. And some of the engineering construction technology that we are implementing are, well, one of the most common, I would say, photovoltaic PV investments, carport PVs and rooftop PV, which are eligible for that federal ITC credit, which is at 26% currently. The current administration is working on the Build Back Better plan to be approved. So we're quite anxious for that to potentially get approved. If that does get approved, our financials will only get better. Battery energy storage systems, fuel cells, where we have 7 fuel cells across our portfolio in the United States. All of them run on biogas, except one, which is our New York fuel cell, which is currently running on natural gas, which we plan to switch over in 2025 to biogas in order to align our sustainability goals. And then renewable heating and cooling projects, which I will discuss further later on. Here's an example of our new carport PV systems, a beautiful picture of our project in Baltimore, Maryland, where we are offsetting 100% of our energy consumption. Rooftop PV, which is the less expensive of the procedures, and also what we call an R&R procedure, or remove and replace procedure. We remove our existing PV, which is old technology. We're talking about panels that have 220 watts on them. The current technology of PV panels is 490. So if we can remove our existing 220 watt panels with new ones, we can double our on-site consumption within the same space constraint. So that's definitely something that we look at all of our projects. And then battery energy storage systems, as I said before, shave peak demand charges, provide savings to the site, and really creates that microgrid resiliency, or what we like to call energy independence. Each site could potentially have be energy independent and potentially use the utility grid as backup. So it's the other way around. We wouldn't necessarily be getting electricity from the grid. We would have our own resiliency and then use the grid as backup. Eliminates fossil fuel peaking, works with smart programming software, and leverages solar incentives as well. So definitely a key component there. The software is intelligent, and it really looks at those shade peak demand features. Fuel cells convert fuel to electricity without combustion to deliver resilient energy. I really like to call this in simple terms a magic box that has an anode and a cathode through a chemical reaction, and it turns natural gas into electricity that is much cleaner than what we get from the grid. Then renewable heating and cooling. What is renewable heating and cooling? Building HVAC system design optimization, fancy term, but in layman's terms, it's basically projects that will eliminate the use of fossil fuels as a main source of energy from our operations. Today, our rooftop units, our HVAC rooftop units have fossil fuels, use natural gas as backup. We are looking to eliminate that through a new central plant configuration and system design optimization in our HVAC systems. So some of the criteria that we use in our renewable heating, cooling, and engineering design is to choose a system with the lowest total life cycle cost, decrease bottom line operation expenses, decrease CO2 emissions, and decrease global warming potential, and also phase out harmful refrigerants as well. An example of our approach to that is we look at our current operations, which is the status quo or business as usual, what it costs us to run our existing rooftop units. Our sites have anywhere from 30 to 50 rooftop units on them. So basically, we look at the total life cycle cost through our 25-year cash flow model. We compare that against 4 different system design HVAC options, direct expansion units, air-cooled chillers, water-cooled chillers, and then water-cooled chillers or magnetic bearing chillers with heat recovery. Heat recovery can be fulfilled with, for example, operations through IKEA food, cold equipment that he is recovered and used internally through a closed loop. In this case, this came as the lowest total life cycle cost and coincidentally also has the lowest energy consumption, CO2 emissions, and global warming potential. When we go through this process, we don't always encounter that it happens like that. So it's really a balance between profitability and sustainability and finding that sweet spot. And to close off, a beautiful picture of our Baltimore, Maryland project, Sustainability Matters. And thank you, Engineering Sustainability for People, Planet Positive.
Thank you very much, Adrian. That's very exciting to see all of the different technologies that you guys are leveraging at your facilities. Next, I would like to welcome Gautami Palanki, Vice President of Sustainability for the Howard Hughes Corporation. She is responsible for leading sustainable strategy and advancing the company's commitment to innovative placemaking, design excellence, and operational high performance. Prior to her current position, Gautami spent several years working as Director for Technical Development at the USGBC and Director for Client Solutions at ArcSquare. So she's got experience kind of on both sides of the table. Welcome, Gautami. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks, Annika. Hi, everyone. Thank you for allowing me to share my new story with the Howard Hughes Corporation. I hope you can see my screen okay and hear me okay. I'll expect a chat if that's not how it's working. Some of you may have heard about the Howard Hughes Corporation. We are a developer of master planned communities in the United States. And what that means is we're looking at about 115,000 acres across six states. So that would be the Seaport in New York, Ward Village in Hawaii, the Woodlands in Texas, the Woodlands Hills in Texas, Summerlin, Las Vegas, Nevada, downtown Columbia, Maryland, Bridgeland, Texas, Louisiana, Chicago, Virginia, and our newest acquisition is Douglas Ranch. It's just outside Phoenix, Arizona, and covers about 37,000 acres. That's about 100,000 homes. The reason I share this with you is to show a scale of what we're seeing across the country in terms of development. This includes homes, commercial development like offices, hotels, and other retail facilities. So what does that mean from an ESG perspective? When we think about our community that is in these master plan communities, we want to deliver a very high quality of life. And when we think about what it means to deliver a high quality of life, a lot of the foundational aspects of LEED come into play. So we sent out a survey and what we heard back is when someone wants to move into a new community, they're thinking about a healthy place to live. And what does that mean? It means good water quality, good air quality, access to amenities that their kids and their parents have, and the ability to be one with nature. Especially after COVID and the pandemic, we're seeing an increase in the association with nature and mental health. And so we are very fortunate that even though we continue to build new cities across the country, what we saw in our communities and learned from it is that when we deliver a high quality of life, it really resonates with several principles in LEED. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. So within Howard Hughes, the ESG or environmental, social, and governance principles are divided between three of my colleagues. I lead the environmental aspect of it. My colleague Clara leads social and DEI. And of course, our governance resides with our risk committee and our legal department. There's a lot to talk about ESG. And what the reason I pulled up my website is to show you different resources that you can look at after this conversation. So for example, we publish our ESG progress goals and programs in our ESG annual report, which is available for download. And we are on our fourth version right now. And it's a 100-page document that does take a while to put together. But I encourage you to look at our companies and any company's ESG report to get a sense of course, how LEED ties into ESG principles, but also what the real estate industry is trying to do as a whole across the globe. Typically, when we think about ESG, it comes down to a few key elements. Within the environmental realm, it comes down to monitoring, measuring, and reporting on progress against key performance indicators. As you would have guessed, these are energy, water, waste, carbon, materials, and biodiversity. And of course, there are many more, and you can fit them into an umbrella or a bucket of your choice. You're also going to hear a lot from different companies that are setting ambitious goals, like you've heard on the call today, you know, to be net zero, net positive in the coming years. The change that I've seen in the most recent timeframe is that in the last couple of years, the movement has moved from definitely setting a far-fetched goal many years down the line, but also setting incremental goals. So what are you going to do on an annual basis is definitely a question that everyone's trying to grasp, absorb, and report on. Within the environmental section, you will see a repeated emphasis on certifications. And the reason certifications are important is because they're third-party validated and assure the observer that this particular property, community, or a city has gone through a rigorous global standard to achieve a certain level of environmental performance. So if I talk about that a little bit more for the Howard Hughes Corporation, we are divided into three main segments. We have master planned communities, which are fairly large in size. If I could give you an example, the Woodlands, which is our community in Texas outside Houston, is about 1.5 times the size of Manhattan. So that is the scale of the community we're looking at. So for something of that nature, we use the LEED for Communities program because it helps us understand, you know, many years after the community was built, developed, and is being used by its residents, how is it performing? And so applying the LEED for Communities framework gave us a standard to collect data, report on data, benchmark our performance. Our second segment is our operational assets. These are our offices, multifamily buildings, hospitals, hotels, schools that serve the community in multiple ways. And so for our operational assets, we look at various rating systems to ensure that on an ongoing basis, our buildings are performing the way they were designed. Of course, LEED for operations and maintenance comes to mind when we think about this. In addition to LEED O&M, you can use, we also have our entire portfolio in the ARC platform, which helps us report on data and benchmark within our portfolio. And our third group of assets are our new developments. These would be properties that are being designed right now, and that will be constructed and delivered, you know, over the years. And so, of course, for those communities, we do use the LEED for New Construction or LEED for Core and Shell rating systems. And the reason for that is to ensure that across the six states that we simultaneously build in, we're able to deliver consistently a healthy and environmentally preferential product. So whether we're in Hawaii, in New York, in Nevada, or in Texas, we want to make sure that when you walk into a Howard Hughes office building, It has the same quality and assurance across every state, and LEAD helps us to deliver that. So as you think about applying different LEAD rating systems to different ESG goals in different parts of the world and the country, the benefit of having this globally recognized rating system is that it offers consistency across the board. So no matter if we're delivering a whole community or if we're delivering a single office building or multifamily building, we know that the brand of LEAD delivers the quality of life that we're looking for. So in our report, we also publish on an annual basis where our certified properties are located, how many, and of course, we want that number to increase year over year. Within the ESG report, you're going to find a lot of information, including the environmental aspects that I just described, but also some of our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. So we know we have work to do, and we are taking different approaches to make that happen. So for example, we have scholarships that encourage people from different backgrounds to intern with the Howard Hughes Corporation, learn about real estate, and really take on that as a career, because we know real estate is not well represented. And so that's one of our programs. Another program is within our talent acquisition strategy. We do understand where our gaps are, and we look to fill those gaps with qualified, smart people who, again, may not have been equally represented previously. So we have a significant number of DEI related programs and efforts on an ongoing basis. At the end of the day, it really matters to us how our community feels in our master plan community, and they stay, enjoy, and invite other people to share this space with them. And so giving back to our community is a big part of our ESG platform. We contribute through volunteer hours or financially to over 350 causes. That's about $3 million a year. And you'll see that through the pandemic, it's really helped us engage very directly with our community. So whether it's a festival, an art festival, a food drive, or other kinds of charitable giving, philanthropy is a big part of our S or social. I'll end with governance, perhaps the least glamorous of the topics within the ESG world, but really very critical, because it helps you administer policies, frameworks, and various other efforts in a very consistent manner that is overseen by the legal and risk departments. And so we have a pretty robust structure to help us deliver on various governance policies across our national portfolio. So I'll end with that and say, ESG is a growing world. It's an evolving world. We learn every day on what can be done new, better, and faster. So I'll encourage you to learn more about us. And of course, I think through the moderated Q&A coming up next, we'll be able to share some more. So thank you for having me today.
Thank you very much, Gatmi. I'd like to ask all of our panelists to turn their cameras back on. And while they do that, if you, as our guests, our participants, attendees, wouldn't mind putting your questions, we have a Q&A function here in the webinar, the Zoom webinar. Or if you see other questions posted and want to upvote the ones that you'd like to see answered, that would be a great way to participate. I will start to ask some of the questions that I have, but we'd love to hear from you and what you would like to know from our panelists. So please do post your questions. My first question is about stewardship. Each organization represented by our speakers today has an inherent role in the organization in stewardship. As I noted earlier, the Smithsonian stewards our artifacts, our art, our culture, our history. The IKEA organization stewards a really large quantity of resources through materials in the products they make, but also energy, water, through the buildings, the facilities that they operate. And the Howard Hughes organization is stewarding land through the development that they produce. So I would like to know from each of you, since stewardship is a really important role of the function of the organizations that you represent, what your commitment to ESG issues, what does it mean to your stakeholders, whether they're internal or external? What value do you think it brings to them? And if you've got examples of what you've heard from them, feedback or metrics, it would be great to hear. And I'll start with the Smithsonian, Charles or Brenda, if you'd like to share.
Well, definitely, yes. We are committed to being a steward in sustainability. And in fact, as soon as we had our first directive published in 2006, it was the first time that we were writing a scope of work for a new project, and that was the African American Museum. So we said, this project is going to be our green flag on the mall. This is going to be an example to show everybody that yes, you can do sustainable buildings, and you can go as far as gold for buildings that demand the amount of temperature and humidity control that our buildings require, because it's not like we can change very easily from morning to day. Our main inhabitants are artifacts, and the artifacts have very strong requirements for humidity and temperature control. And also the amount of visitors that we have. We have millions of visitors in all our museums. So there is a big demand for energy. And we try to show everybody that our buildings, still with all that demand, can be energy efficient and show, be a steward of that.
I'd like to add to that, that I think all of the panelists have demonstrated that they have put their goals in writing and they've quantified that, and then have set interim goals in terms of measuring where they've come and what they're going to. And I think that's really a key part of the whole accountability process as part of that stewardship.
We do have a department which is called energy management, and they actually are the ones in charge of tracking all our energy uses and can tell us how we are performing and whether we are meeting our goals or not.
Annika, for something like the Howard Hughes Corporation, a publicly traded company, we're also seeing questions from our investors and of course at the board level in terms of what our ESG plans are, what is our long-term approach and short-term progress towards those goals. You know, so from one end, from the investor community, we are seeing questions. And then of course, on the other end, our quote unquote consumers, you know, like the people who live, work and play in our buildings are definitely, we're seeing an increased awareness in what it means to be in a healthy building. And, you know, sometimes it's LEED, sometimes it could be a smaller portion of a green cleaning product. Like, it depends what they know. But yes, everyone from a stakeholder to a consumer is gaining a significant awareness about what it means to be in a healthy building.
Adrian, do you feel like your internal or external stakeholders find value in your commitment to these issues? Sorry, Adrian, you may be muted if you are responding. Sorry.
Question, please.
Do you find either your internal or external stakeholders, that could be your consumers or it could be employees of the organization, find that there's value, added value in IKEA's commitment to sustainability issues?
Sure. I think the IKEA vision is to create a better everyday life for the many people. And we believe that a better life is a healthier and more sustainable one. Our vision is our inspiration. We want to have that positive impact on people, society, and the planet. So for us, it's balancing economic growth and positive social impact with environmental protection and generation. I think that at IKEA, we have a huge responsibility and opportunity to tackle climate crisis, and we want to be part of that, building that future that's better for the planet and people. I think that's why we've set these very ambitious goals for 2030 to inspire and enable more than 1 billion people to live better lives within the limits of the planet, to become climate positive and regenerate resources while growing the IKEA business and create that social positive impact for everyone across the IKEA value chain.
Thank you. I'm going to take one of our audience questions. For each organization, if you're not pursuing LEED on a specific project or facility, how would you track environmental metrics or ensure that you're meeting your goals and reporting them? So if you're not pursuing LEED or another third-party certification, and that could be due to the project scope being limited, or maybe that it's not required for that type of project, but how would you track and report if it wasn't worth a certification?
A simple spreadsheet goes a long way. I think I would look at certification as the end goal, not the starting point. Start simple. Every building has data, you just need to find that person who has that data, on their computer or, on a printed document. But every ESG program really starts with an Excel spreadsheet, enter information. There's also free tools available. Energy Star Portfolio Manager is a free tool. So you can enter your energy data and benchmark performance. ARC by the US Green Building Council is a free tool. You can enter data and benchmark your performance. So, you don't have to start with a certification program, start with what you have access to.
I'd like to chime in terms of part of that is benchmarking against what's the standard and try to measure the aspects there and then look for ways to improve upon, to try to be better than average. And then one of that can be enhanced each year going along.
Great. And we can have a different
projects.
Go ahead, Brenda, please. Yeah.
No, we also have a lot of projects that are not LEED certified, as we said, but because there is the mechanical and electrical big demand in our buildings, we do commission a lot of those buildings, a lot of those partial projects. They never go to LEED because they're just, limited to an area. So we do commissioning, we do a lot of training, and we do a lot of tracking and recommissioning when needed.
And use the building management systems and that type of thing too.
That's a really great point that if it's just because you're not doing a certification, there's no reason not to do the commissioning and no reason not to make sure your BMS is tracking all of that data and reporting back. And to Gautami's point that you can use Portfolio Manager or other tracking tools to manage your whole portfolio, whether or not there's a certification involved. Adrian, there was a question for you. When you are doing your remove and replace projects with your PV, which I think is astonishing how far our technology has come, that we're getting more than twice the production capability out of newer PV technology. What do you do with the older panels? How are they recycled, recommissioned? What happens to them?
Well, we typically, when we put together an RFP, we make sure that whoever is awarded the contract for the project recycles them appropriately. We've reached out and partnered with recycling companies that take care of that for us. I think the raw material from which silicone and polysilicone is made of can be recycled, I believe, to 80 to 85%, and some other components less. So it's definitely embedded in the process of the RFP and the recycling company that takes care of that specific procedure.
All right, so my next question is really about health and well-being. What aspects of your ESG programs are you seeing have the biggest impacts on health and well-being of your occupants or customers or other stakeholders? And are there financial benefits as well? I will start, Gautami, if you would like to share what you guys have learned.
Sure. I think the last 2 years have been a big learning experience, right? On a personal and professional level. I think we're learning that it's a collaborative effort between the person coming into the building and the person managing the building. It can't just work with one person doing half the thing. It has to be done. It has to be done in collaboration. We're also obviously learning one size doesn't fit all. You know, there are some basic minimums, ventilation, cleanliness, et cetera, that need to go into the space on an ongoing basis. And many buildings do that. The next step is to really look back and see what we can do in design, you know, whether that's access to nature, biophilia, healthy materials. And then at the end of the day, how does that all come together for and be inclusive of everyone who's in the building. So I wish there was one silver bullet that we could implement everywhere, but I think we've learned so much in the last 2 years and are able to quickly enforce and implement that in our buildings. Again, if we talk about just some of the pragmatic, tangible elements, indoor environmental quality monitoring, whether that's through sensors or data acquisition systems, reporting that through free and paid software, and of course, certifying and validating it through certifications are definitely steps of the process.
I think keying on to that part of it is just the use of sensors, attention to air quality, fresh air changes, the filtration, the quality of the filters, and all those things have become heightened in, you know, with the advent of COVID. And I think that's got some pretty far-reaching impacts in terms of just how we view building environments and how organizations view their employees and what's good for the employees.
Adrian, is there anything you'd like to share about how health and well-being have been impacting your green building?
I think our tenants have a remarkable opportunity to help shift the sustainability in retail operations and in the process define a new kind of shopping experience. By locating our projects to LEED Silver, potentially gold buildings, tenants will benefit from improved indoor air quality, natural daylighting, comprehensive waste management, recycling opportunities, and lower energy costs. I think these and other elements combine to create a healthier, happy workplace and improve the indoor environment for our employees and our customers. We also look at a different type of energy performance indicators, power optimization, all sorts of indoor quality air improvements that could potentially track CO2 monitoring and elsewhere for our customers and our co-workers to have sustainable environments for them to develop and achieve their experience.
Great, thank you. There's a question around leased spaces, and I think this is twofold. You've all mentioned being responsible for leased space in one way or another, either leasing from others or leasing to others. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what the challenges are when you don't own the space, and what the opportunities are. What can you accomplish? What types of things do you do with the portion of that scope that isn't within your control or your influence? And potentially, if there are things that you're able to do within your lease agreement. And then as well as if you have tenants, what you're hearing from them about their requests for sustainability or well-being. I'll start, Gautami, if you would like to go first.
Sure. I was just thinking about this, Annika, like there are so many ways to answer this question a bit vaguely, right? Depends on the market, depends on the building type, depends on da-da-da. But I think at the end of the day, no tenant is going to say no to a healthy building. And I think it's a bit of a collaboration of, you know, how we market it, you know, how we talk about the pragmatic and tangible benefits, and how that resonates. So for example, we are delivering a medical office building. And you know, we want the building to enhance the health of anyone coming into it, not just in a medical office building, but in a multifamily building, in an office building. So I think we're seeing a couple of aspects. One, green leases are a good way to interject contractual language around sustainability. Second, we're seeing a demand also from a tenant side. You know, certain, especially with relocations from California and other tech markets to inner cities, we're seeing that, you know, their leases come with the requirement of LEED Silver or LEED Gold. So there's some tenant-driven activity as well. And then, of course, with the pandemic, as residents move into buildings or relocate, they're looking for quality of life, which is reflected through amenities or access to nature or you know, efficiency or renewable energy. And all of those aspects are covered by LEED. So while they may not say, I want a LEED certified building, they are highlighting the aspects that would be in a LEED certified building.
I think part of it too is really kind of educating the public in terms of what the benefits are of these characteristics. And then when it comes to being a tenant seeking out buildings, state what the goals are at, you know, when you start looking for space. And in some cases, go ahead and lay out minimums so that, for instance, that we will not consider a building that's less than LEED Gold. And for almost every landlord that is seeking to lease space to tenants, they want to be on the short list. They want to be on the tour and to know upfront that they're not even going to be considered unless they're LEED Gold. That sets the bar. And one thing that is important for our members to really understand is who are the influencers and then who are the decision makers, that so that the employees say to their leadership, we want and we value great air quality. We value working in healthy buildings, and we value what the impact is to the environment, so that the leadership values these things when they look at quality versus monetary trade-offs, and then setting out what it is that they're going to consider and what it is they're not going to consider. I think Brenda brought out a great thing in terms of Smithsonian back in 2006 and laid the bar down that for projects of 2.5 million and greater, it's got to be X. If it's 5 million and greater, it's got to be Y. And to lay that down, and so that everybody knows kind of what the ground rules are. The development community will build whatever is demanded. And so that we want a groundswell of consumers, as in office users, that demand or want those characteristics. And they lay it out there up front.
Annika, if I could plug USGBC for 1 second here. I think as an organization, they're doing a tremendous job of raising awareness and especially with the Top 10 campaign, I think it's a good talking point to say, hey, mass is in the Top 10, which means if you're not building to lead in that state, something's off. And so I think, what I'd look for more from the USGBC is to perhaps illustrate lead in more simple terms, so folks who are not from the AEC industry can understand the benefits and really demand it when it comes to the buildings they want to buy or move into.
When you get in major markets such as Washington, D.C., you're really not considered Class A or trophy unless you are typically lead gold or platinum. For other buildings in other cities, I've heard, many cases developers will build buildings generally to lead standards, but they don't want to go through the certification process. And what we want to do is for potential customers to say, we do want certification. We want documentation. That's part of the accountability process, so that we're not just saying something, but that we actually have something to back it up.
Those are really great points. And this will be my final question, because I know we'll have some wrap up comments from our chapter. We have been going through a year or two, I believe, of some real-time beta v4.1 changes, which has been a really great, I think, sort of experiment. Like, let's see what works and while people try out different credit alterations. And so I know the USGBC is sort of anxious to get this out to ballot and formalize the changes that we've all been trying on for size. So in this moment we have, before we crystallize and formalize those changes, is there anything that you think is a change that should stick, or is there anything that's been an obstacle or really difficult hurdle within LEAD that you'd like to see change for the better? And there's been some questions in our Q&A around ESG and DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. Are there some things around social impact that you think LEAD could do better? Or are there barriers within sort of the structural format of LEAD or specific criteria related to credits? You can take this question wherever you'd like. I'd just like to hear from you how you think LEAD is doing something really well or you'd like to see it change. And I'll start perhaps with Adrian and then move to the other panelists.
Sure, thanks, Annika. We've been working with sustainability for quite a while, and the way we see sustainability is really how we can create a better life for the many. So it's economic, social, and environmental, because if you go all in and maximize profit and benefit for a few and at the detriment of the many, then you really aren't there for the many people. And if you go all in on environment, maybe you go bankrupt. So it's really finding that balance between the three. And I think that's really the core from the beginning. So some of the biggest challenges that we face in terms of ESG sustainability goals are sustainable consumption, inequality, and climate change. We're really trying to tackle how we can contribute as an organization, because we know we're part of the problem, but we also want to be part of the solution. So we're developing a strategy for the business. We're painting a picture why this is more relevant for us as a business. So three areas: healthy and sustainable living, climate positive and circular, and fair and equal are part of our business strategy. So I think it's important to encourage development in areas with existing infrastructure, and then all the concepts from the engineering perspective in terms of optimizing energy performance, advanced energy metering, renewable energy production, and long-term commitment, I think, is what IKEA is all about. We're really looking at this as a long-term commitment.
Thank you. That's great to hear. Brenda or Charles, is there anything you would like
to add? One of the things I would add is trying to not soften the rules per se, but create situations where existing buildings can document and qualify for O&M, as well as that the rules are more attainable for those in rural and small town locations. For instance, like the emphasis on mass transit, that is so dependent upon the local government that an individual site or building owner has very limited, you know, control over that. We can advocate, but in terms of penalizing a site or a building owner because they don't have mass transit, it might be mass transit where it's available versus mass transit in a black and white manner.
That's a great point. And I've heard that from several other building owners and developers. Gautami, would you like to have the final word before Terry gives us her closing remarks?
Yes, I'll be quick, Terry. So what I like about 4.1 is the data performance-driven approach. It's not once and done. You have to stay at it, which is basically the principles for ESG. So I like the data-driven performance benchmarking aspect of 4.1. What I'd love to see more is the intersection between buildings, communities, cities, and climate action plans. I think we're all working towards the same goal, but there isn't a very clean path to get there. And I feel like with data, we can. So I think there's an opportunity there for USGBC to really link their rating systems or nest the rating systems from an interior space to a building, to a community, to a city. And I'm happy to help if you need it.
Thank you so much. I can't thank our panelists enough for your participation today. It's been great to hear from your organizations, what your larger organizations are doing and what your unique roles are within those organizations helping to drive these issues forward. Terry, please bring us home.
Absolutely. Thank you all for such an engaging presentation. Annika, wonderful, wonderful questions. Gautami, terrific to hear what Howard Hughes is doing, particularly in integration of ARC, which we always like to hear. And Charles and Brenda, so fascinating to hear what a premium the Smithsonian puts on sustainability in building and operations. Adrian, thank you for that look behind the scenes. And we are cheering you on as you head to Lead Zero. Thank you all. And we'd also like one more time to thank our volunteers, our generous annual partners, and you, our audience, for the great questions, for your attention and your support. We hope to see you at another USGBC event very soon. Bye now.
Thanks, everyone.